You're listening to Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF, and now another presentation of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard.
This is Elbert Big Man Howard with you once again with Voices from Behind the Walls, where we're doing readings from the works of Eddie Marshall Conway from his book, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. That's Eddie Conway and Dominic Stevens. Today we'll go into chapter 4. We will begin there and see where we go from there. So we appreciate you tuning in, and we hope that you enjoy this and that you will continue to listen to KWTF Community Radio, Sonoma County, and the world.
My name is David Engel, reading from Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. This is Chapter 4, Work is Struggle. It was of vital importance to the struggle that all party members were well informed, so everyone was required to attend a political education classes twice a week in order to remain in good standing. We took these classes very seriously because there were consequences attached to slacking. Running a mile was the standard punishment, but the bigger consequence was a lack of knowledge. During the initial formation of the party, it became clear that we had to look to the struggles of other peoples, especially those in the so-called Third World, for some of the solutions to our problems. The political education classes were held at night in the offices after most members returned from their daily assignments and had their supper. I was so thoroughly convinced that BPP was the best instrument for change available to black folks that I even asked my mother to join. She once told a friend of mine that while she had family obligations that would not permit her to join us, she never objected to what we were doing, and in fact, many of the older people she knew were glad the Panthers were active in the community. Widespread community support was of critical importance to the Panthers, and we always took great care to take heed of the voices of the community, something that I have continued to abide by in my organizing work in prison. But back to the past. At the time, many party members lived on the floors above the offices on Gay Street, which had bedrooms upstairs and a few cots downstairs. A decent number of members could sleep over on any given night that they wanted to, and many did because of the late hours that we kept. On the nights that we held the political education classes, everyone would gather in the classroom while the assigned lieutenant would start the class off with a brief rundown on something that was in our newspaper, The Panther, and we would discuss the chosen article, which was usually about new policies or some major event that affected the BPP or black communities. These were also the things that we would discuss with the people we came into contact with in the neighborhoods. Most of our members were young people looking to be a part of something that could change the status quo in this country. These youth had often seen their parents struggle economically while also contending with Jim Crow laws and practices. Many of the young women in the party had also come from a tradition where women assumed so-called non-traditional roles. Women of African descent always have. I found it important to treat these women as comrades. During the early part of my involvement with the Panthers, Kay and I were still together, and she participated in some of our party activities, so it was also important to me to show every woman the respect that they were due. However, there were the usual complications that occur when passions flare, both politically and otherwise. On one occasion, a young woman I had come to know and work with attempted suicide. She had been pursuing me relentlessly, and when I did not respond, she shot herself. Fortunately, it was only a flesh wound in the leg, but she was expelled from the party. The Little Red Book, otherwise known as Quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong, was the foundation for most of our classes. Although we used other textbooks, the Little Red Book remained the main text throughout the party's history, and during this time it became the most popular revolutionary book in America. I don't know if that was because we were using it or if it was being used because of that, but it was easy to obtain and written so simply that it was easy for most people to understand. It became the lifeblood of the BPP's political training program. All conflicts or confrontations would send the disagreeing parties dashing off to find their copy of the Little Red Book to resolve the debate. The Little Red Book was the final word on any subject. Not even party directives or rules survived if they were in real disagreement with the Little Red Book. We would sometimes spend hours during a class examining a key chapter from the book, with each passage read aloud and discussed by the whole class, until there was a general agreement that everyone understood the subject matter. We were young and eager to advance our thinking, and our strong desire for learning was reflected by the fact that we spent hours each night reading and discussing this or that subject from the Little Red Book. Our thirst for knowledge was a result of our wish to see better socioeconomic arrangement for our people and communities. We simply needed the truth, having been handed lies all our lives. As we gained knowledge, some of us worked to establish offices in other areas of the region, like South Baltimore and Annapolis, and got involved in these communities' political issues. In Baltimore, the chapter had begun organizing around some problems at Frederick Douglass High School, and a public rally we helped to put together in support of the community's concerns would soon result in two carloads of Panthers being arrested on trumped-up charges. The falsified charges were later dropped, but this would set the tone for our future dealings with Baltimore City officials, especially the police department. It was the start of what would soon become weekly police harassment of the Baltimore Black Panther Party. Our members were being arrested in ever-increasing numbers for very minor things, and this soon escalated from situations like traffic stops and violations to some of our members facing charges for burglaries and robberies, and eventually homicide. The alleged murder of police officers would soon take the place of the mythological rape of white women as the basis for the legal lynching of black men. In April of 1969, James Brown was scheduled to appear on behalf of Richard Nixon in what was being billed as a decency rally at Baltimore's Memorial Stadium. Needless to say, there was little decency involved in this event, and in a sense, it was little more than a case of the government trying to use music as a distraction to soothe the savage beast. The stadium was jam-packed with people, and so we, the local chapter of the BPP, saw this as an ideal opportunity to speak with them. A similar rally had been held in Miami, Florida, and several others were scheduled to happen around the country. There was a sort of Woodstock atmosphere in the air, even though we were in urban America, which has suddenly become Black America. The people were relaxed and waiting, even though it was 90 degrees in the shade on this particular day. We waited and waited, but James Brown failed to emerge, and as the sun took its toll, people started to get restless. Well, after about 2 hours of waiting, we Panthers, along with anti-war activists and other progressive groups, tried to negotiate some time on the mic until James Brown arrived. This brought a massive and immediate response from the security guards, and we were forced to leave the Centerfield staging area. Our group then decided to march around the walls of the stadium. We shouted slogans and interacted with the crowd. We started off with about 100 people, but soon grew much larger. The officials who organized the rally did not like this, and we were expelled after a verbal confrontation. About an hour after we left the stadium, the rally turned into a major riot when it became apparent that James Brown was a no-show. People who were both hot and angry as they filed out of the stadium were met with hostility as the police aggressively forced the crowd to disperse. As tempers flared, fights broke out, and crowds blocked the main thoroughfare, only to be charged or trampled by police on horseback. They were swinging their batons from above and knocking people over. In some cases, they rode right over people who fell down in the mad rush that ensued. It was a disaster and perhaps the most indecent decency rally ever staged, but fortunately, this became the last one that the government attempted to hold. The presence of the Panthers and our attempts to speak to the crowd became connected with the riot, even though it occurred over an hour after we had left, and was largely the result of people being mistreated by the police after waiting in the heat for a performer who did not materialize. Suddenly, things started happening around our chapter office on different levels. First, our electricity was cut off, and the company claimed it was a billing error. Next, a 24-hour surveillance post was set up across the street from us, and police began to tail all known Panther vehicles in both unmarked cars and regular patrol cars. Ultimately, they managed to infiltrate our organization at a number of different levels, and though we were unaware of who these agents might be at the time, we knew that infiltration was a real possibility. Despite these setbacks, we held our first successful rally. It took place at Clifton Park on Malcolm X's birthday and drew over 1,000 people. The program consisted largely of several speakers from the BPP, followed by a bull roast. The rally was really the first time that the police made themselves fully visible to us after weeks of covert harassment. The park was overrun by a massive number of policemen in uniforms and a large number of plainclothes men photographing the participants. Many of these men who were sworn to uphold the law spent their time inventing incidents among the crowd that led to harassment and eventually spread to people simply walking near the rally site. We eventually dispersed because we did not have a permit. While we were committed to education and knew the value of such books as The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon, the BPP leadership had long believed that the best way to advance our communities was to actively address the problems that existed. One of our early efforts was a food co-op that allowed us to provide low-cost groceries for the community while netting enough profit to cover party expenses. Another project that eventually was picked up by others outside the party was the People's Health Clinic, located on Greenmount Avenue. The clinic is still in existence today and provides inexpensive health care to the uninsured. Almost every BPP chapter in the country had developed a free breakfast program in their community to feed hungry children. We started our program after polling the neighborhood for miles around the office to see if a need existed and if a program would receive support from the community members if we started it. Once we were convinced that the community was strongly supportive of such a program, we began to contact individuals and organizations that might help us locate a site from which to operate. Help came from a community-based church order. We were given the use of the basement of the St. Martin de Porres Community Center, which was a couple miles from our main office. We all pitched in to paint and clean the place, and many people from the community also came out to help us. They were mostly children, but some parents pitched in to help as well. We expanded the community assigned to manage the breakfast program, inviting members of the community to join, both youth and adults. BPP members made contact with as many stores in the area as possible, and each of these businesses were asked to donate anything that they could to aid in the development of this program. Many of the business owners felt that the program was a good idea and much needed in the community, so they willingly gave as much as they reasonably could in the form of food, paper plates, and other supplies required to feed large numbers of children. There were, of course, some neighborhood store owners who refused to aid the program. We assigned teams to investigate those stores and find out how much money they were making off of the community. The stores that took money from the community but gave nothing back were subjected to a community boycott. Armed with the information about their profits and lack of return to the black community, we put up signs in the area exposing these businesses and then established pickets in front of those places. This brought a quick response from most of the holdouts. However, true to capitalist form, some still would not contribute resources to feed the hungry children in the community. We kept the pressure up on these stores until we were forced to stop the boycotts on our own, because the community youth were starting to get a bit violent towards these stores and the owners were blaming us and the boycotts for these actions. Of course, it never occurred to the owners that the youth of the community might legitimately feel some anger towards them for refusing to support a program that was designed to feed these same youth. And the local papers came down on the side of the owners and the police and continued to harass the Panthers in their pages. Nevertheless, the program proved to be successful, and it eventually grew so large that we had to go to bigger businesses to get enough food and supplies to meet the rising demand. Teams went out with information packages to request support from larger companies, and many of them gave whatever they could. The only reason the program had to be limited was time and personnel. You could only feed so many children in a given space and time. Our numbers ranged from between 25 and 100 children a day. Every morning, 5 days a week, we opened the place up, cleaned it, and set up the tables. Around 8 a.m., we would start cooking and the children would also begin to arrive. We had cars that picked up the children who lived a mile or more away from the program. There were always a number of parents and sisters and brothers from the community to stay with the children until the food was ready. We fed everyone there, adults and children alike. When the first group of kids had finished, they were driven to school and the next group would be brought in to start the process over again. Since Kay and I both worked nights, we would go straight to the breakfast program when we got off work. She would cook, and I would drive the children back and forth between the program and school. There was always real pressure on supporters to stop assisting the program. A 1969 memo from J. Edgar Hoover to 24 FBI offices stated, quote, "The free breakfast program represents the best and most influential activity going for the BPP, and as such is potentially the greatest threat to efforts by authorities to neutralize the BPP and destroy what it stands for." Shortly thereafter, the now infamous coloring book program was started by the FBI to discredit the Black Panther breakfast programs across the country. Some weeks later, odd things began to happen within our chapter. A few people would leave the office to go somewhere, and they would be arrested en route and kept overnight on an investigation of some alleged crime. Groups of Black Panthers would go out to attend different events, such as a rally or speaking engagement, and of the 10 members who might go, only 8 would return. No one would know what had happened to the other two, until they showed up the next day mad as hell because they had been left behind or had an engine failure on some lonely highway. Our cars were starting to break down on a regular basis. Finally, when one of our buildings caught fire, I was put in charge of security for the Baltimore chapter, and this included the welfare of our members as well as the buildings. All special events had to be checked out, and all new individuals coming into the chapter were scrutinized. I spent a lot of time just checking out the backgrounds of people who were interested in joining the party or working close to us. There was also the monumental task of finding out about the people who were already in the party. This included finding out who was working where and what they were doing. It became a continual process of checking on a number of people and things at any given time. I soon became aware that we had some serious internal problems, and it was likely that they had existed right from the inception of the Baltimore chapter. Within the numbers of incidents that were occurring regularly, it was clear that there were agents operating inside the chapter. There were many times that I reported security violations to the defense captain, Warren Hart, but all too often no action was taken to deal with the problem or to investigate the situation any further. The problems continued to escalate, and we lost 2 more cars, not to mention the fact that our members were still being left here and there at random. Finally, during an open house gathering at our headquarters, we caught someone photographing the inside of our offices in areas that shouldn't have been open to the public. When I inquired with Hart, he told me that he had authorized this action. I felt compelled to take my concerns to a higher level because at that point it was impossible to tell who among the local leadership was really on our side. It had become obvious that our branch had been infiltrated by government agents. But where the infiltration started and stopped was still unclear. National headquarters agreed to send us a team of investigators. The regional field marshal from New York, Donald Cox, who was responsible for operations on the East Coast, brought his own team down to investigate the information that had been gathered and to hold hearings. Warren Hart and several other people were tried. I had been called out to Oakland, so I was not present. But when I returned, several people were gone. We would eventually discover that our defense captain, who was the highest-ranking Panther in the state of Maryland, was a paid agent of the National Security Agency. Several other members were working for other law enforcement agencies, one for the FBI, 2 for local police department, and another for some agency whose name remains unknown. They had been working both individually and collectively as information gatherers and agent provocateurs, and had successfully set up a number of our members on various charges. These activities created a climate of fear and suspicion that left our chapter seriously wounded, and this situation wasn't limited to Baltimore. Similar activities were taking place in most of our chapters around the country. National progressive movements were shifting their stance from the belief that this country's problems were simply the result of racism or capitalism. The government's reaction to our movements resulted in a new form of fascism that was uniquely American, operating under the guise of law and order. In July 1969, a national conference was organized in Oakland, California, to form a united front to combat fascism. Representatives from every state and several different organizations besides the Black Panther Party attended this conference. The Panthers on the East Coast used New York as their jumping-off point. We had at the time chapters from Halifax, Nova Scotia to Raleigh, North Carolina, but all the chapters who had people going by their northern route left from New York. Our small caravan consisted of about four cars of brothers and sisters looking very much like Black Panthers with the berets and black leather jackets. For me, the sojourn was a study in the many facets of black culture as we made our way across the country, stopping in most of the major cities along the way. Each time we would go into the black community and check out the local chapter or simply the community. The striking similarity between the communities left me believing that you could fall asleep in one ghetto and wake up in another city inside the black community and never realize you were in a different state. To see this with my own eyes convinced me that the blight and utter impoverishment that were being seen had to be the result of a national policy of neglect supported by capitalist agenda that rendered poor people useless as more and more jobs disappeared from their communities. Everywhere I looked, we saw the same liquor stores, dilapidated housing, and young men on the corners, and always the excessive policing. The only variation that existed was among the people themselves. They ran the full range of color from high yellow to blue-black, and spoke with their various regional dialects. To me, this was a reflection of the true beauty and diversity that exists among black people. Unfortunately, I missed the opportunity to meet Fred Hampton because when we were passing through Chicago, I had elected to find a secluded place to teach Zaid Shakur how to drive a stick shift. We had set out with 12 people in our caravan, but only a handful of us could drive, and even fewer could operate a stick. And, of course, one of the vehicles was a Volkswagen Bug, a necessary prop on the set of the 1970s, or so it seems to us these days. Of all the New York members of the BPP, Zaid was the person with whom I had been most acquainted. I stayed with him whenever I went to New York to train with party members there. He was an intelligent cat that was light years ahead of the reparations movement in regards to getting money from the government. So while others went to meet with the members of the Chicago chapter, I sat in a jerking car giving advice as Zaid tried to get the routine down. By the time we reached Oakland and the conference site, it was very clear that we had a real problem, and soon an open debate about fascism in America took place. In 1969, some groups and key individuals on the left took the position that the U.S. could not be a fascist state because of the two-party system. They pointed out that there were no secret police nor any centralization of the government or of wealth, while others believed that there was no real opposition between the two major political parties. For many of us Panthers, though, everything in our own collective experience pointed to a system designed to repress and ultimately eliminate our freedom. In fact, our liberty had always been questionable when juxtaposed against capitalism. For me, this was what our struggle was really about, and coupled with the hospitality extended to us by members of the Oakland chapter, I felt a strong sense of community and collectivism. John Seal, brother of Bobby Seal, who would eventually become BPP chairman, and his family were very accommodating to us. Several of the comrades and I had come from warm climates, and our choice of clothing reflected this. Well, John and the others provided us with clothing that was more appropriate to Oakland's chill, in addition to housing and food.
Down to the top of a mountain.
We are reading from Martial Law by Marshall Eddie Conway. We're in Chapter 4. My name is Don Compo. Besides some of the basic and not unexpected differences around goals and objectives, there existed the very real problem of drug use among some members of the anti-war movement on a 24-hour basis. Though some of our members drank and smoked a little marijuana from time to time, the days of wild abandonment and overindulgence in the earliest days of the Panther Party in Baltimore were long since over. Assassinations of our members and infiltrations of our officers around the country had imbued our work with a new seriousness. Getting high was not all that cool with us when our lives were on the line 24 hours a day. Because of the attacks on Panther offices, we often had arms among us, and no one trusted anyone who was under the influences of drugs around the firearms. There was also the problem of race relations, since so many of our members had come to the BPP by way of some of the black nationalist movements and organizations, or held pro-nationalist views that were deeply ingrained. This made trust among the groups rather difficult. despite efforts on both sides to change these attitudes. And finally, there was the resultant anger caused by relationships between black men and white women, a result of the free love concepts of the white radical movement. Eventually, one such relationship between a member of the party and the wife of a white lawyer sympathetic to the cause would become a source of provocation for the FBI, who circulated a false letter making public the infidelity. Many sisters in the BPP openly opposed these relationships, as did some community supporters, and I am certain that a similar position was held by some of the white male radicals. Several sisters conveyed the belief that these relationships were taking available black men away from them, while brothers tended to overlook their concerns about these relationships. The sum total of all these problems made it impossible to establish anything other than a loosely structured supportive network between black and white activists. There was a wide and disparate level of representation from the black community. Membership in the party ranged from street hustlers or the lumpen to college students and academics. On the other hand, the majority of the white activists who we encountered in the anti-war movement were of a privileged class. Whites were who were at an economic advantage had the privilege of devoting time to the movement. Poor whites and blacks were not afforded such convenience. With this distinction of class also came white supremacy and the unconscious racism that has always existed among less politicized white radicals. This was reflected in their attempts to run, direct, or lead anything we were jointly involved in, which resulted in an immediate backlash from our members almost every time and every point. The relationship we shared with the old guard left, and by this I mean the American Communist Party, and labor and union organizers was even more distant than our relationship to new left groups like the Students for a Democratic Society, the Young Socialist Workers Party, and the White Panther Party. There seemed to be a more concrete exchange with the old left in a number of areas, but there was never any real trust between us because we believed that they had sold out by becoming middle-class Americans, while they tended to believe that we were young, crazy blacks who might do anything at any time. They gave us support in many areas, but kept a good distance from us and our activities. But on the whole, among the various leftist groups, there was a real effect to defend the movement from the continued attacks by the right wing of the American government. The rapid growth of the BPP after a number of armed actions on the West Coast was as much responsible for its decline as anything else. The fact that this allowed thousands of new members to flood the ranks of each chapter while ill-trained personnel were allowed to open new chapters with little or no real guidance. This led to problems in maintaining uniformity and collective policies. The new influx of members were, for the most part, accepted after the death of Dr. King, and these members had recently come through the wave of riots that swept America's cities after King's assassination. Most were angry as hell and ready to fight the system on any level. There were more new members than the old comrades could safely absorb. This was the time of the government's greatest efforts to infiltrate their agents into the party. It seems that every law enforcement agency from local, state, and national levels placed their agents within not only the Black Panther Party, but also any other progressive group on the political terrain, although there seemed to be special orders about catalyzing violence and conflict among the Panthers in particular. A number of organizations were developing at the time, but the BPP was at the top of the list for removal or disruption. Closely following the BPP for that honor were the Brown Berets, the American Indian Movement, the Young Lords, the White Panthers, SDS, and the anti-war movement. The Black Panther Party was making a serious effort to bring all these groups together under the united front to combat fascism. The government, of course, was prepared to do anything in its power to stop us from uniting around a common cause. That made significant use of the media, often feeding publication stories that discredited the Panthers. Differences in race and politics provided a variety of angles from which to target the different groups and disrupt organizing efforts. Their misinformation campaigns helped to nurse latent doubts that existed within these groups about who was using whom and for what purpose. The media, for example, did their best to paint a misleading picture of internal conflicts between the leadership of the BPP
in the hopes of destabilizing the BPP's entire base of operations. Yet, chapters continued to grow and expand, even in the face of repeated attacks by law enforcement, the media, and right-wing organizations. The negative press was actually serving as a recruitment tool for us. Many people were attracted to the BPP because of the negative media image. They would sometimes try to actualize their ideas about revenge and violence, and this made them prime victims for agent provocateurs within the ranks of the local and national organizational structure. It was about this time that the national government decided that it was time to get in on the kill publicity. They did this by holding a number of well-publicized congressional hearings spearheaded by the so-called House Committee on Un-American Activities, which called a number of law enforcement officials to testify before nationwide television networks and paint a picture of the Black Panther Party as wild, crazy niggers who ate babies. This hideous show was designed to prepare the public for the coming attacks against the party, attacks designed to completely disrupt the BPP and shatter its leadership once and for all. So these hearings focused on two aspects of the party, the internal treatment of its members and the external relationship with the community. First to be used in this effort were a husband and wife team of the so-called ex-Panthers in full uniforms. No one had ever heard of them, but that never mattered before. They testified that the BPP forced them to stay in the party and to do a lot of things that were against their principles. They saw the rape of a young teenage girl by BPP members and described massive drug use and armed robberies by the party leadership. The second level of attack was directed at the breakfast program. This is where the now infamous coloring book, a coloring book that was supposed to teach little children how to kill policemen, was presented on national television as a product of the BPP's breakfast program. The fact that this book was designed, produced, and distributed by the FBI would be proven later, but the damage was done. They mailed it to companies that had supported the program with donations of food. Groups and individuals began to withdraw their building or material support for the breakfast program. The fact that the United States Congress was reporting these things meant that most average Americans believed them. In time, most states would implement free lunch programs in the schools and eventually add free breakfast programs. Since, as the Panthers had demonstrated, much to the chagrin of the political leaders of the country, these were resources sorely needed in communities across the nation. In Baltimore, the Maryland Food Committee was set up to undermine the BPP's nutrition program because it promoted self-determination in the black community. The local black churches that moved in to fill the program's needs were suddenly being supplied with federal funds to do so. Shortly after these media attacks began, the government began to mount much more deadly offensives. One of the first occurred in Chicago, and it would result in the silencing of one of the party's key organizers in that city, Illinois Chairman Fred Hampton. The mood in our office in December 1969 was one of shock and anger over the news that this was trickling out of Chicago. Initial reports said that a number of Black Panthers had been shot and wounded in a shootout with police while resisting arrest in a pre-dawn raid. However, the word from our national headquarters was that Chairman Fred had been assassinated in his sleep by a combined team of state, local, and federal enforcement agents. He had just become a member of the BPP Central Committee, the national body governing the party. We were certain that the long-awaited attacks had started, and now the realizations had begun to sink in that it wouldn't be long before the fate of many of our comrades would befall us as well. As the details of what happened in Chicago continued to trickle in, our members moved around the office as if a wake were taking place. We had not gotten beyond this tragedy, had no time to consider a defense, when we received news of yet another attack on our leadership. Bobby Seale had been arrested and shipped to New Haven, Connecticut on trumped-up murder charges. Yet another national leader was being removed from the Central Committee by the reactionary forces of the government. Things looked very dismal at that moment, but my political resolve remained intact even as my personal life was beginning to unravel. It was enough to have to realize that we were facing opposition from a government that intended to squash our movement, but on top of that, to be confronted with the loss of so many comrades, so many young people who would never see the future they were working to impact. It was too much. I'm sure that my family members feared for my well-being, and the responsibilities that came along with my commitment to the Panthers were affecting my relationship with Kay, who simply needed more than I could give. John Huggins and Bunchy Carter had been assassinated the year before in Los Angeles. Eldridge Cleaver was in exile in Cuba, having fled falsified charges resulting from the confrontation with the Oakland police, who had summarily executed little Bobby Hutton, and Huey Newton was essentially fighting for his life in California, though he would later be released. Now Fred Hampton had been assassinated in his sleep. We were losing community support while these attacks were being stepped up, and guidance and management of party affairs had been truncated. Black community leaders, the type that were usually appointed by City Hall and only speak out about things when there's a problem that City Hall wants talked about, were suddenly talking their heads off. By the following week, news reached us that the FBI had asked the Baltimore City Police to get indictments for the leadership of our chapter. They were saying one of their informants was missing and he was supposed to be working out of one of our offices. We had seen and known this brother they were talking about, so we checked out his whereabouts with his sister. She told us that she had talked to him 2 weeks before and that he was being sent somewhere by the company he worked for. The FBI claimed he was missing for over 3 months. A similar charge was being leveled at Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins up in New Haven, Connecticut. It was yet another missing informant case that would prove to be an attempt to frame the BPP leadership. We discussed the situation with our lawyer and decided to wait until they took some type of action. In the meantime, we gathered as much information as we could about what was going on. Up front, it seemed as though they had infiltrated one of their agents into our chapter and eventually just sent him elsewhere or instructed him to hide. But the Baltimore City Police had other ideas. Leakin Park in West Baltimore had always had some notoriety, probably primarily because of the number of bodies that have been dumped there over the years. It seemed to yield more bodies than some local cemeteries, and this became very convenient for the local police. They used one of these unidentified bodies to move on our leadership in the chapter, claiming that it was the remains of an informant who had been killed by several members. It became known as the Bag of Bones case. The remains would soon be identified as belonging to a white male. All of the members who were charged with this murder would eventually be acquitted, except for one who chose to accept a plea deal early on in the case. He would later receive a pardon from the governor. Since all the people we worked with were informed and believed an attack was the real motive behind this whole setup, we continued to work, but stayed on the defensive since attacks were being directed at almost every chapter across the nation. Less than 2 weeks later, another attack came, but it occurred away from our office and involved a member who the police claimed was involved in a robbery attempt. The result was a dead Panther, a brother by the name of Drummond. The facts were murky at best, so I investigated it with the police in the neighborhood where the shooting had occurred, and their story was very different from the one being told by the police. The media was on strike that week, so it was not covered, and eventually it went down as a justified police shooting, and that was that. By the time Fred Hampton was murdered in his sleep, Kay and I were no longer living together. I had moved to a neighborhood in West Baltimore, and she had taken Ronald and moved to New York. Our marriage had been fraught with conflict, in part due to her own personal issues, but largely due to the fact that I had often placed more importance on the struggle than on my own family. It had been my belief that by making conditions better in the community, I would also make things better for my own family. In retrospect, my activism made things worse. Our family was broken, and Ronald would grow up without a father around. Since returning from the service, I had also been the glue that had held my extended family together, and in a few short years, this would also be irrevocably altered. These days, I can tell you that the greatest regret of my life is the fact that I wasn't there for so many people, including my children and my mother, during some of the roughest years of their lives. But back then, despite being married and being a parent, I was still young and selfish. None of those things were as important to me as me and what I wanted. And what I wanted was bigger than family. It was freedom for myself and my people. This has been Chapter 4 of Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther, written by Marshal Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson. My name is Don Compo. I've been reading today. David Engel has been reading, and also Elbert Big Man Howard. You're listening to Voices from Behind the Walls, hosted by Elbert Big Man Howard here on Community Radio for Sonoma County and the World, KWTF. Stay tuned next time for more Voices from Behind the Walls.
This is Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF. For more information, how to volunteer or donate, go to our website, kwtf.net.